Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Bad Gay Movies. This is, of course, Bill speaking. I hope you're all doing very well. As of the time that I'm recording this, there is still no verdict in the trial of the century, which is, of course, Gwyneth versus the old Dr. Skeer. And I just can't wait to see how that turns out. Of course, I have been riveted to my screen. It's like gay OJ. And let me tell you something. I don't know that I ever want to have lunch with Gwyneth Paltrow, but I do adore her. And I'd also like to say that if you're a 75-year-old man who decides to go skiing and roll the dice with your health that way, nothing that happens to you on that trip, good or bad, is going to make it possible for you to enjoy a wine and cheese after. I feel like even the slightest bump is something you'll never recover from. So why are you punishing our Gwyneth for being pretty and better than you? I don't really know. And also, this is a sport that young people die in all the time. We lost Gaspar Ulliel to skiing last year, so just be grateful that you got out of it with your life. And the worst thing that happened to you was that a woman screamed at you, which, by the way, is the reason why that trial is happening, is that he fell foolishly in front of a girl and he's embarrassed. And she found out that her money can't keep her from having to hang around with normies, and this is why they're fighting it out, and everyone in that courtroom is rolling their goddamn eyes but cashing a check. Anyway, speaking of magnificent movie stars, we have a major one to talk about today, and I'll be doing that with the great Curtis Campbell, who was previously on this show, to talk about that movie starring Diego Rivera's grandson that was based on a book that I read. What was it called? Kept Boy? Rent Boy? Anyway, Curtis is here to talk about The Fan, and Curtis will promote his own stuff, but I have a few more rather set dates for him. His next play, Blake and Clay's Gay Agenda, will be premiering at the Toronto Fringe this summer. This is the sequel to Gay for Pay with Blake and Clay, which my magnificent co-host Daniel Krolik starred in last year and was a runaway hit that had like extra performances lasting until about a month ago. Curtis also has his book coming out in October. It's called Dragging Mason County. I will post links on our show notes for you to find out about it, find out release dates and pre-orders as well. He's one of the smartest, most brilliant guys out there, so you definitely want to soak up as much of his work as you possibly can. I should also mention, if you enjoy the Lola and Lonnie podcast, Alanis Percocet and Merlola Bordeaux, say that five times fast, will be debuting a podcast soon called Recap with Lola and Lonnie, which is going to be talking about Drag Race season 35, so you can look out for that as well. But until then, you can contact us here at Bad Gay Movies on the socials, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, Instagram. Write to us at badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Visit us on the web at badgaymovies.com. And please enjoy the episode.
Unlike the others, I want nothing from you. The only thing that matters to me is your happiness. I am a friend, and I am someone you can turn to in times of distress. But I know the time is now right. We will be lovers very soon, my darling. And believe me, I have all the necessary equipment to make you very, very happy. You had a
really... Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your host, Bill Antoniou. Today we're going to talk about The Fan by Ed Bianchi, and with me is a returning guest who I'm so thrilled to talk to again, the one and only Curtis Campbell. Curtis, the last time you were here, you were absolutely nobody, and look at you now.
I know, and everything's changed, and all it took was dyeing my hair blonde.
That's all it took. And a boob job. No, you have had a wonderful year, as our listeners will know from having heard Daniel talk about it. You co-wrote with him the magnificent play, Gay for Pay with Blake and Clay, which I have so far seen twice. I'm hoping to come to the next iteration in March. which will have been done by the time this this drops. Tell us a little about the experience for you before we get into the film. What the experience of Blake and Clay was for you, other than the torture of having to work with one Daniel Kerlick.
Oh, horrific. It was kind of a wild whirlwind of an experience. It was not at all what we had planned for our year as collaborators. And then a fringe slot just dropped ever so daintily into our laps, and we had this lovely opportunity to do whatever the fuck we wanted, and it was really lovely. We really just went off and wrote exactly the thing that we wanted to make. I think we knew that we were really happy with the show and that we had not compromised the thing that we wanted to make and the level of snark that we wanted to achieve with it, and it was really rewarding to bring it to Fringe here in Toronto and have people pick up on it so quickly. Yeah, it was wild. And then you know, we were lucky enough to Jonathan Wilson was persistent enough to pester the fine folks over at Crow's to let us have a 2-week run there, which was a fun time. Yeah. And now we're bringing the sequel to Toronto Fringe 2023. So by the time this comes out, it'll be maybe a month or two away, but we're bringing Blake and Clay's Gay Agenda to the Toronto Fringe.
Terrific. So this great year goes into like a second great year. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's been fun.
You know, I knew you before this show, and I knew, of course, that you're lovely and smart and talented, but I'm sure that the people closest to you knew everything there was to know about your skills. But for a lot of us, watching that play made us realize just how brilliant you are. And, you know, Daniel personally would tell me how much he credited you with many aspects of that show that were so incisive. And how did it feel for you to have to get to show that off?
It's funny because Daniel will quickly, even in the rehearsal room, pass the buck on the script. But I think Daniel is always the person who finds a very human way to do the really cartoonish things that I want to do.
Right.
And I think, you know, he is one of the many collaborators in my life who says, that's an insane thing. What if it was like a real person doing it? And I go, oh, you're right. This is people saying and doing stuff. Yeah, it was really lovely and really, I think it was a bit of a game changer for Daniel and I, because Daniel and I are really obsessed with each other and each other's brains. But I think you get locked into this cycle. And I have this with a few collaborators where we're like, no one will ever see how genius I think you are and like how much you make me laugh. It's, you know, it's going to be you and I forever. Mm-hmm. And it was really wild seeing people respond to that. And I think especially like post COVID and post really going on my own journey with like, what the fuck am I doing as an artist? Am I screaming into the void? And yeah, it was kind of wild to have people see what we do and say yes to it, and then really say yes to it. And yeah, it was really cool. Like I always, you know, John, I've said this to Daniel many times before we went into it, but Jonathan Wilson's Normal Heart was one of the first shows I saw when I went to theater school where I said, okay, wow, this is what I want to do. I mean, I knew that I wanted to do it, but seeing the kind of work and really having that reinforced, like, this is the direction to keep moving towards. And then to be somehow in charge of the room with him on stage was kind of wild. Yeah, it was crazy. And now we're sort of chasing that, like, what's the post-coital move here?
Well, speaking of theater, Curtis, we have today a film that really straddles these worlds. It deals a lot with Broadway. It's actually produced. This movie's produced by Robert Stigwood, who is a Broadway producer. Is he not? Is he not a musical? He produced Evita, the movie.
Yeah, you'll have to ask the other half of Blake and Clay. Daniel would know these things.
Correct. Yeah. Well, I told him we were recording today, but he's busy having whatever. A life. Having family drama right now.
I know.
It's directed by Ed Bianchi, who is actually still working. He directed episodes of City on a Hill last year, and he's done. His career has mainly been television, so like episodes of SVU, Deadwood, Yellowstone, Ray Donovan.
It's had a very Law and Order energy to it.
For sure. Well, he made this film. This is his first. I don't think it's his first directorial credit, but is it before he did television? But after this, he didn't make another feature for 10 years. And the feature he made 10 years after this is actually a movie I've always wanted to find. I've never seen it. It's called Off and Running. It's actually the movie where Cyndi Lauper met her husband because she is the star of it.
I didn't know she did other features. I always just think of her as Vibes.
Vibes. And well, I think she's only been in a handful. She's also in that movie Life with Mikey with Michael J. Fox. She has a supporting role in that.
Love that for them.
And then, of course, she won an Emmy Award for Mad About You.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I don't know. Paul Reiser is having like a resurgence, and I love that for him.
Yeah, I guess because of the Kominsky method. And also, didn't they bring Mad About You back?
They brought Mad About You back, and like, I guess someone's aunt watched it.
I still have never seen that show.
No.
So my first question about The Fan is, I mean, I have a lot to say about this movie. I also have to say, I love this movie. I don't think it's good, but I love this movie.
I unironically enjoyed it. Yeah. Like, I think it really sags in, like...
There's a lot to enjoy.
There is a lot to enjoy. It has some script sag, but I was watching it with my partner, and several times I stopped and I said, oh, I feel like this actually takes place in a real rehearsal hall.
Like
a real, when they are dancing, mm-hmm. and when they're in it, I was like, oh, this feels like, and maybe it's just that 80s grit where everything, like no one was really bending over backwards to make anything look overly aspirational.
Right.
It had this like very realistic bric-a-brac energy to the rehearsal hall. Even her like opulent New York apartment wasn't, you know, it wasn't something out of like a Ryan Murphy.
Yeah. It's not an Aaron Spelling apartment.
No, exactly.
It's wealthy, but it feels lived in some way. Mm-hmm. And their rehearsals, I mean, that's exactly what I always think of New York rehearsal rooms looking like, especially for musicals. Mm-hmm. My question is this a horror movie? I actually first saw this movie like 6 months ago when I covered the 80s horror collection on the Criterion channel, which is why I watched it for the first time, although I'd been meaning to watch it for a long time. And I immediately thought this has to be on BGM. And yeah. Something about your love of her decaffeinated commercials made me think it would be the perfect movie to talk about with you.
Yes.
I say that bad. I live with you. But is it a horror movie? Because I know that he's wielding a razor.
He is wielding a razor several times. Razor in the pool.
How do you get away with that is what I'd like to know.
Razor in the pool was gay culture. Okay, so we're going into this podcast assuming that the viewership has watched.
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Okay, great. So there were so many moments to me that said, this is gay culture and gay culture is for me. And one of them was swimming under someone doing laps in the New York YMCA,
yeah,
slowly unsheathing your straight razor, yeah, and absolutely gutting him like a fish,
which you can hold in your swimming suit somehow.
Which, well, he had like a bulky swimming. He had, well, I mean, not bulky because it was the 80s and skimp was the word. And
was that a swimming suit though, or was he wearing his boxer shorts? I can never decide that.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that he improvised that compared to the full-on black speedo that was going on with our friend Michael. I believe his name is Michael swimming.
Yeah.
Honestly,
body on that guy.
The whole time I was like, these men are so attractive, and none of them are ripped. They have a perfectly fit body.
Yeah.
All of them. This I said in the 80s, people really knew how to wear jeans.
They did. And also that guy, that Michael guy, that is the aspirational gay man's body in the 80s. It's not ripped, ripped as the 90s. He's like that kind of
a turnip twink.
Yeah, like a Broadway dancer body, basically. He's unfortunately also, he died of AIDS in 1986, so not long after this movie. And the choreographer, Reed Jones, who plays the choreographer, who was in Cats for a long time, he died in 1989. So this movie is also capturing a real moment with gay.
It really felt like that. Yeah, it was a New York that looked like New York. It didn't have that sort of, it's Netflix and it's set in New York energy, right, where everything's just a little too placed.
But it also hasn't become the Desperately Seeking Susan New York yet either, even though I'm sure parts of it were. But like, it feels like that hasn't quite happened yet, that real rot in the 80s.
Yeah, it wasn't. It felt like a place that people lived. It didn't feel like it was being editorialized in either direction.
Right.
I think that, but that's kind of my issue with the film as a whole is, was it a thriller? Not fully. Was it a horror? No, it's not a horror.
Because the technical definition is that a thriller, someone explained this to me once, a thriller is when good is pursuing bad, and a horror is when bad is pursuing good.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And that's what the brilliance of The Silence of the Lambs is, because it does both. And in this case, it is bad going after good. It's not a, it's like a police comes in later, right? So it's not like it's a detective thriller where someone's hunting down a madman. We know who the madman is and we're watching him. So technically it's a horror movie, but it doesn't, it has a thriller energy to me. Also, he doesn't kill anyone until closer to the end. He's mostly just hurting people, hurting them in a way that I never want anyone to be hurt, but he doesn't kill anyone until he kills the gay guy and then the dresser and then the doorman at the end. Or he kills the maid, right?
He does kill the maid.
It looks like she's dead. I don't know. I don't understand how you... He drags that razor across her bra in a way that I can't even imagine the fabric being cut, but blood just spurts out.
It just spurts, right? Yeah, that was my partner and I said the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's dead, I guess?
She's wearing like 80s level women's underclothing, which means that there's no way he's getting through all those layers that quickly. Yeah. There's no way. And she's not wearing a lacy bra under there.
No, she's a sensible lady. She's got work to do. I enjoyed the gradual amp up of he's not starting out killing, but it did. Yeah, I think by definition, then it is a horror movie.
Yeah.
But it had these really lovely bits to. I always think of. Have you ever had David Benjamin Tomlinson on the show?
I have not. No.
Oh, you should. You guys would get on the gas on fire. But David showed me Poltergeist for the first time, and I was like, oh no, I've never really, you know, it's never really caught my interest. And he showed me the movie, and we just gushed about it afterwards, because you have that really lovely, realistic relationship between
the hottest parents in the 80s. Yeah,
the hottest parents in the 80s. But what he pointed out to me, and that I've always like really stuck with me, was you get to see these parents just smoking a joint and like unwinding after a day of just being regular parents in the 80s, and sort of having that like beautiful energy that that whole era of film has, where the takes are still kind of long. People are still kind of talking over each other. There's
a lived in quality. Yeah.
There's a lived in quality. And what really worked for me was, you know, this relationship between Lauren Bacall and her her manager, her assistant.
Yeah. Maureen Stapleton.
Oh, just wonderful. And with hair stacked to the heavens.
I mean, the best wig that her price range could afford, but yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that really worked for me. And so the, you know, that energy of it sort of undercut the more salacious horror bits, or what I would consider like a contemporary horror movie.
Yeah, this movie somewhat succeeds at being a character piece, but it really doesn't. And the parts where it does succeed, it's so good. And it is particularly that relationship. Although I have to say, I don't understand why Maureen Stapleton, or Belle is her name, I don't understand why she can't just pretend that the letters are coming from Sally herself.
Yeah.
Like anytime I've interacted with a celebrity, I always just assume I'm hearing through an intermediary, including when they tweet me, you know.
Well, it's, you know, you have a long tweet relationship with so many famous actresses.
Do I?
of our era. Can you imagine, like, what would Toni Collette do with Twitter?
Toni Collette, I don't get the impression that she really enjoys being a front-facing, like, connected celebrity. So she would probably have an assistant. I think she would have the Tom Cruise Twitter, which is basically an assistant just making sure dates are being promoted. Like, this movie comes out here. Here's the trailer. Here's this.
I think Toni would be promoting nonprofit work that has something to do with the film that she's releasing.
Sure. Yeah,
I think that would be her thing. I enjoyed their relationship. I thought that it worked, but it also spoke to this thing of like, if we're going to get a good character, a good sense of who these two characters are, fantastic. I needed to know a little bit more about who the fan was, the titular role.
Well, this is the ultimate problem with this movie. So when it came out in 1981, it was looked down upon very, like, it did not do well. In particular, it was considered to be a movie made in very bad taste because celebrity stalkings had made headlines quite a bit in the last few years. Like, John Lennon was killed not long before this.
Right.
And so this movie is seen as a sort of soulless exploitation of something that people were much more concerned about. It has rehabilitated its status somewhat in the last decade or so, just because, you know, the way celebrity culture is now, this movie seems quite dainty by comparison.
Well, it just seems like Twitter.
Yes, although I also wonder, like, do we have guys like this anymore, or does Twitter help sort of release that tension where people can just be cruel to other people instead of being to the celebrity themselves?
I think it releases that tension, and it also provides a much more extreme version of this. Like, I think that type of person is more likely to be radicalized or right. some sort of, you know, flat earther energy.
Yeah.
One tiny, thin, gauzy layer away from anti-Semitism right. at all times. So I do think that, but yeah, the whole time I was like, this is, you know, weirdly tame given what has happened since, but still effective.
Yeah. And Lauren Bacall herself said that she was kind of embarrassed by this movie when she first made it. And then years later watched it and thought, oh, that's actually one of my better performances. And I think she's fantastic in this film. I mean, I think it's a truly great performance, and it's a shame that the movie doesn't quite live up to it.
She's fantastic. And I think there is a different movie going on within this movie, which is the relationship between her and her ex-husband, which yes. felt so realistic.
Well, there's a lot that this movie could be, including the fact that in the early 80s, you're not going to have a studio film want to be openly about a gay man. And that robs this movie of a lot of substance, because yeah. And I don't need this movie to be like a 3-hour long, you know, Oscar winning drama. I just mean more psychological context for the way that he is behaving.
Yeah.
Because he is a case of inner homophobia. I mean, that's yes. how I read this movie.
Yeah.
Particularly the fact that when he goes to a gay bar later in this movie, the director does not film that gay bar like it's a place of freaks, the way 80s yeah. studio movies made gay bars into. It's actually a normal place where normal people hang out, and he's the one who can't blend in or be comfortable there.
Yeah, that really shone through. It was kind yes. of shocking. It was not at all what I was expecting.
Especially because when I watch an 80s movie and anything gay comes up, like, I brace myself for like yeah. the worst, you know, and so I was surprised by this. But there is a story to be told about the fact that his inability to deal with his own sexuality sublimates itself into an increased obsession with an actress that he would be a big fan of anyway.
Yeah.
But it's amped up by the fact that he can't deal with himself. And so he has to create this whole fantasy world about her, including making artichokes for dinner to watch her.
That was my sweet partner, who is a wonderful chef.
Yeah.
Said these. He's like, oh, he did some artichokes for their dinner. That's nice.
Yeah. Like, it's one thing to just be obsessively watching her all the time. It's another thing to like set a place setting and like an elegant table.
And that was my issue with his character as a whole, was I kept coming back to I kept saying he doesn't want to fuck her, and I don't think that the writer or director thinks that he wants to fuck her.
No,
but we need to get, I don't even need that much. I need one 15 second something that makes it very clear that, like, this is an act. This is a violent act of repression of himself.
Yeah.
Because, like, that was the more sensational part, obviously, of a movie that had some really real relationships. Like, yeah, the relationship that the movie between Lauren Bacall and her. And her ex-husband,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I've seen, I'm trying to think of other movies I've watched where a heterosexual couple has broken up and remains friends yeah. and sort of active in each other's lives that isn't, you know, Marriage Story.
Right.
Where they have a kid and they have to, and they're both still, you know, children about it. But that was really, I was like, oh, that is a more realistic depiction of the people I know and the relationships that I've had.
And then an example of the fact that this movie kind of has it but doesn't quite go there is, it's a shame that her being in this Broadway musical, which, by the way, what is this musical about?
But that's a whole feat. That's a whole part of today's
right,
episode.
We can save that for the end. But the show Never Say Never, as it's called. But that should be more integrated into the vulnerability she is feeling, because, you know, I would give anything to be a star on Broadway. It is not something to be looked down upon, but this is also a familiar trajectory, including for the real Lauren Bacall herself, which is that in your heyday, you were an A-list movie star. And now that you are older, you are settling for being a Broadway star. It is less. It is not something that, again, I think lowly of. But that is, and so she's dealing with no longer being as popular as she was in her heyday. I mean, the fan mail that she's getting is mostly people who loved her way back when, including him. Like, he's obsessed with the image of her as the star he watched on television.
And he has old photos of Lauren Bacall.
Right, which is also...
So I should say younger photos of Lauren Bacall.
Right, which speaks also to this, like, sort of sublimation of his gay identity into this obsession with images, right?
Yes.
And so, and she's dealing with getting older. Her ex-husband makes her feel insecure because he is dating a much younger woman. Mm-hmm. So why is this Broadway show not more involved in the stakes of what's happening, which is that, oh my God, I have to deal with this. And on top of that, now someone's trying to kill me. Like, I'm no longer as popular as I was when I was a studio movie star, but my popularity has now taken the form of having to deal with somebody who wants to murder me and is hurting the people around me.
And it's her first musical, which she makes a point to say on the first day of rehearsal.
Yeah.
It's her first musical, which there
and
is...
How worried I get for her during that key change and that hearts and diamonds.
Oh my God. Why again?
I brace myself.
We have to save that for another part of the episode, because the entire thing was spectacularly terrible.
Because there's a part where she decides she can't take it anymore. She runs away to her country home. Speaking of the dream. Yeah. Speaking of sitting around, scenes of people sitting around. I mean, Lauren Bacall, cigarette on the couch with that bottle of Absolut vodka that is disappearing quickly.
Oil lamp burning.
God. That's not what should be happening. What should be happening is that she needs this show to open because her career needs it. She needs it for her ego. And she's having to negotiate between what risks she's willing to take with this crazy fan, given how important this show is to her. And it's a shame that the movie doesn't quite get that house of cards together. Yeah.
There are so many layers to this that really hinted at a larger and more developed, interesting story.
Yeah.
I mean, the, like, her relationship with Michael, her young co-star, maybe co-star, we don't really get a sense of that, is, you know, that's really lovely too. Relationship with her husband, relationship with her, with her assistant, which is, you know, fairly fleshed out.
Yeah.
But there are all these lovely layers to it that could have really popped, I think, if it had taken just a little bit more time to make those things land, you know, and not relied so heavily on the voiceovers of the creepy letters being written by the fan.
Partly because they do such a good job of making her a real person, and they do such a bad job of making him a real person, because they don't want to deal with his gayness, and that's mainly what it is.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, it is, like, kind of refreshing that a woman of a certain age is developed into a fairly three-dimensional person.
Especially because no one was ever better at being a woman of a certain age than Lauren Bacall. Like, I love her as a young woman, but I absolutely love her as a quote-unquote middle-aged woman. She's actually only 57 here. Because she aged the way women of her generation aged.
That's something we kept saying during the movie too, was, wow, people look different now.
They do look different. It's also because Lauren Bacall, for all that she's genuinely beautiful, she wasn't quote unquote pretty, and so she never looked young. You know, even as a 19-year-old, she always looked like an older woman.
That's so funny. You ask any gay man, is this a beautiful woman? A picture of Lauren Bacall? It's a gorgeous woman.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you ask other people, like, it's like the Sarah Jessica Parker thing. Like, it was only ever women and gay men who found her beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And I also love watching her negotiate her worlds in this movie. So, like, as you said, I love her relationship with Belle, because we're also talking about, like, top tier actresses. This is the same year that Maureen Stapleton won her Academy Award for Reds. It came out the same year. Oh. And I also love Lauren Bacall in rooms full of gay men. Like, she is this grand dame that you just love watching everyone buzz around her. I love that first scene of the rehearsal when she's like, doing her first pass at the number, and she lights up, you know, like the way she just rehearses that number in the rehearsal room. It's so exciting to watch her.
And she's so, like, that was the thing, as I was like, oh, this must have been made by theater people.
Right.
the specifics are all there, and the way that you're allowed to watch her just be a professional.
Yeah.
She, you know, she's figuring out the choreography.
Yeah.
She's watching. Okay, so it's this. Great. Boop, boop, boop. But also the larger note that the movie does or maybe doesn't do, does something by omission where you get introduced to these gorgeous gay Broadway dancers, absolutely killing it in their field. And at no point is it a joke that, oh my God, aren't they so fabulous and silly?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not bitching at each other or being catty. They're just being professionals who are very good. You get that little butt slap.
Yep.
Which I think in a certain type of director, that would have been played off as a joke. Whereas in this, it just felt like a part of the world because it was.
It's New York from New York's point of view is what it is. And usually, especially in 80s movies, usually the New York scene, especially the New York art scene, is translated for the Midwestern experience, sort of, which is that, like, it's kind of an only in New York, look what the freaks are doing sort of thing, which is not the case in this film. It's like, this is their world, and they are normal people doing normal things because this is their world.
And the way that translated was really lovely.
I've been in many a rehearsal room, including a mirrored dance rehearsal room. I don't remember so many girls combing their hair in the mirror.
Oh, yes.
So very often.
Well, you know, this is maybe from a gay man's perspective, where
maybe
the dolls are dolling.
Hair was just so much more of a thing in the 80s, you know.
Hair took a lot. A lot of hairspray, a lot of combs.
That
really worked for me, and I found it in a movie that I was going in with a bit of ghoulish expectation. I found that legitimately really lovely and refreshing, and it's like you said, it translated into the scene in the bar, which of course, you know, is a scene in a gay bar, so it has to end in murder. But it translated, it seeped into the rest of the movie so lovely. Especially the, you know, this sort of budding friendship between Lauren Bacall's character and this dancer Michael, who gets killed in the pool. I completely, like, at no point was I questioning, like, oh, like, what's going on with them? Like, why is he taking her out? You know, he should be so lucky to have a companion of such esteem.
Correct. Yeah. And I was actually surprised that we went to a gay bar in this movie, only because up until that point, it's being so careful to avoid the subject that I didn't realize that they would be daring enough to put him in that situation. And then I realized they don't go so far as to show him being tempted to enjoy himself.
He gets a blowjob from a man, but it's so he can kill
barely.
Him.
I mean, that guy barely gets his dick out of his pants before.
No, he was maybe like had just worked the
zipper. Yeah.
The zipper. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's what surprised me about the fact that we were not given purchase at all into the, you know, the geography of his mind.
Yeah.
That you get that his sister is concerned about him and, like, you know, which gay with a sister does not have a sister that is worried about us.
But also, who else is going to be obsessed with an old movie actress? Like, you kind of feel insulted by this movie because, like, why aren't you telling me this about this guy? Like, how could I possibly not think this? On top of which, like, he's come to New York, right? Like, which is one of the places Americans go when they want to be gay. Like, it's a, you know, it's a mecca for that. So, you know, like, who else is gonna even know her address to write her fan letters to and get so intricately involved?
Yeah, it's a gay.
Yeah.
We love that.
But also, where does he go when he's looking for somebody that he wants to murder in order to fake his own death? Like, he goes to a gay bar instead of somewhere else. So, and then I also, this whole thing about him compensating for the way he feels small in real life by being too aggressive in his day job at a record store with a very young Dana Delaney as his coworker.
Oh my God. And we were like, that mullet? Is back. That mullet is back.
It's so great.
The big glasses are back.
Yep.
I mean,
Lauren's big glasses that she wears when she comes to the rehearsal for the first time. So
great. I mean, a mullet and some big glasses. I'm here for it. I also, something that I picked up on is in movies in like the 80s and the 90s, people seemed really unbothered by like the status of their job. He is a terrible employee.
Yeah.
He's a dick to his boss. He's not doing the most basic of things.
Yeah.
And he seems very unbothered by that. And I was like, wow, people just must have been able to just get jobs back then.
I mean, I don't know. Is 1981 before the sort of Reagan era recession? Probably.
I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
Like, you don't get the impression that it's like it's a ravaged New York, which is what happens later. Like by the mid 80s, between the economics and AIDS, New York becomes like a war zone. Right.
Right. Yeah, not present, but anyway, he seemed very unbothered. He's terrible at his job.
Yeah, and he cares about being great at a really dumb job. Like, you just work at a record store. Just work at a record store.
Where's work at a record store? I would work at a record store.
Like, you're young, you're super cute, and you're in New York City. Just, like, get laid and work at a record store. What else do you need from this life?
Yeah, those are all... If I could just work at one job and have that be... a record store and have that be enough and just live my life, that would be great. But it is 2023 and that is not a thing I can do.
Yeah. Not at the prices of New York rent. Michael Biehn is also super, super young and adorable in this movie. I think he's so sexy. He's got the worst hands, but otherwise he's
perfect. I have no concept of this actor.
He's most famous for the James Cameron movies he was in later on in the same decade. So he was in the first Terminator, he was in Aliens, and he was in The Abyss.
Oh my God. Okay.
I don't know what's up with his life. I feel like he kind of dropped off, although he works still to this day. I want to say that there might have been like a substance abuse problem somewhere along the way, but I don't know that for a fact, so don't quote me on that. He's aged like a straight guy, and that's okay.
Oh.
But he was super, super hot in the 80s and very cute in his trunks in this movie. And an actor, I don't get the impression, would have given too much of a resistance to playing the character more honestly. I don't know that the barrier was him, but I don't know.
I've always felt that about Princess Bride, with Carrie Elwes. Mm-hmm. I've always been like, you play gross creeps sometimes, and sometimes you play the dashing hero.
Yeah.
I always got the feeling that, like, if someone had insinuated that Carrie Elwes was gay, he'd be like, okay.
Yeah. Also, he's like a straight guy, though. Yeah.
Oh, I know. No, he still got it.
Do you think so?
Carrie Elwes currently, yeah, I'd let it. I mean... I would.
I mean, I'd let it too, just so I could tell you about it on the show.
Yeah, that's fair. Speaking of, has Ryan G. Hines ever told you his story of meeting Lauren Bacall?
No, he's told me so many stories about I can't keep them straight, but no, he's told me about Liza and Shirley MacLaine. He's never told me about Lauren.
Yes. Bacall. Oh my God. I watched The Apartment over Christmas on Turner.
Yeah.
For the first time. What a movie.
Yeah. And that's like one of the greatest female performances of the entire decade.
It's
yeah.
so good. And so it feels so contemporary. Like, her performance feels so contemporary. And I was like, you're still watching it with Jack Lemmon, who had such a, over Christmas, I developed such a crush on Jack Lemmon. I watched several of his movies.
Okay.
Cutie patootie, little munchkin. I want to put him in my front pocket and just carry him around. Her performance in that movie feels so right now.
Yeah.
And then, but you're still watching it with Jack Lemmon, who is still sort of that.
He's very much of that time. Yeah.
Of that era. And I was like,
they don't make an uncomfortable mix. Yeah.
No. And I wonder if that sort of dissonance works really well with him, but oh my God, what a natural, just what a bright performance by her. She just shines in that movie.
She definitely deserved to win.
She
lost to a tracheotomy, as the saying goes. It's also one thing I will say about this movie, though, for all that it doesn't do in terms of its character investigation, it's a very modern thing now to make movies where the villains aren't villains, they're just misunderstood. It's rather ahead of its time in this movie that he's not just a bad guy killing people. I mean, this is on the verge of the height of the fame of slasher movies, where the killers don't have personalities. So it's interesting that in this movie we do have a sense of a kind of Ripley, like Mr. Ripley-esque portrait of this guy.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
I was like, this is so close to... Yeah, it felt like it. The choices they were making were stepping in that direction, but it was still... You could feel that...
because he's so excited when he gets a letter from her. There's one scene where he opens the letter that he gets outside his apartment and he's so excited, like he smiles opening it.
Yeah.
And you're like, what a shame that there's not more of this portrait of this like child trapped in an adult's body kind of thing.
And that's it, right? And that's totally, and that's exactly it. And I didn't want it to fall into the trap of, you know, he was abused as a child and therefore people who are abused do these things, because we've seen that more than enough. But I did need a little something, and little things like that really did come through, I think. It was moving in that direction of this is a person doing something because he's a person and people do stuff.
This is a person who never gets to win, and people, you know, and we all live lives where there are days when we win and there are a lot of them when we don't, and we take it in stride and we just look forward to the next one. And some people, when all they do is lose, it eventually piles up and some people can't handle it. And and that takes the form that it takes. It's not always becoming a serial killer. But that's not something that, I mean, that's something that the job thing is kind of hinting at, the fact that he can't get respect at this low-level job.
Oh my God, when he lies about the, and I told off my boss.
Right.
And everyone in the store.
And the fact that he's even writing that to her, you know.
Oh, he feels it made my skin crawl. That was really effective.
And if this movie was able to be more honest about him, imagine if he had some kind of like relationship with a man where he just can't be himself, where he can't settle and be comfortable and like accept the fact that he is in love with a man. And so it all gets displaced into this obsession with this actress.
Yeah. But here's the more maybe like 2000s version of it is his beautiful coworker with the mullet, mullet sent from the heavens, is a beautiful, sensitive straight man,
right,
who is willing to give him the time of day, and he can't handle the fact that he wants to get split in half by like a sensitive record boy who is, you know, into Kate Bush or something. That,
yeah, that could be something too. I mean, that just more than what we get here, you know. There's also, I should mention, a very young Griffin Dunne shows up in this movie as well. He is in the rehearsal room, and then he's actually at the opening night. He kisses her in the dressing room at the end.
So many. It is a train car of kissing.
Yeah, we notice that now post-COVID. Yeah.
You notice it post COVID, but my partner, who is forever having to forgive me the fact that I am a member of the theater community, it's a personality trait that he's willing to look past. He was like, "Oh my God, they just keep kissing each other," and our joke is, "Well, you can't do that now." But also, I was like, no, this is pretty tame, honestly. This is pretty par for the course. Like, this is opening night.
For Broadway, like, you have all these gay men in top physical form and a backstage that goes on for miles, please.
And also, she's their mommy.
Yeah, for sure.
You have to understand, she's mommy.
She's mommy, and you can tell Lauren Bacall is good at being mommy. Like, first of all, Lauren Bacall spent the 70s doing a lot of Broadway plays. So Lauren Bacall already had that job down pat and represents it extremely well in this film. You get the impression, I mean, you see that one scene where she fights with the director and she walks off the stage. So there's probably a lot of that happens just because she works at the top level of intensity of her game and there's a lot to deal with there. But that it's not a toxic room to work in with her either.
No. To have the power on a Broadway stage when you are in tech, when you are paying for tech time that I'm sure is not nearly enough.
Yeah.
To be able to just be done with a scene, have a disagreement with the director, and walk off to your dressing room when we've got like 8 hours of Q2Q ahead of us, that is power. That is
her
mommy.
Stand-in can take care of Q2Q. She doesn't
her
have to be there.
Stand-in can that is power. Yeah. And then to be able to just retire to your country home.
Yeah.
I mean, what more could a girl want?
But I mean, that whole section of the plot doesn't make sense to me. The fact that she comes back in time to open. So someone else filled in for her in previews.
Yeah, it really, that's what I mean. That whole area of the script just sort of deflates for me. The tension really ratchets down when she is able to go out to her country home, because I was like, is he going to find her at the country home? But that would, you know, to have the grand finale be within the theater.
Yeah.
You know, the gays demanded that.
Yeah. It just, the problem too is that there's just no way he would know where her country home is. I find it hard to believe that he would know where she
is. Exactly. And I was like, well, if we're going to be out there, I guess he has to find it, but I don't buy that either. We're going to really strain believability here.
Like, I believe that he could find out where her apartment is.
100%.
Yeah.
Something we need to talk about is the amount of coffee in this movie.
Well, I was so disappointed that she doesn't say it's decaffeinated once. I mean, she's sitting next to the coffee machine with Hector Elizondo as the detective who's investigating her stalker. Oh, she's like, would you like some coffee? How do you take it? Do you take it decaffeinated?
It was there. And how do you take it? I think at one point she even like turns down a cup of coffee and says, it's going to make her too jittery.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's right there. If you have the decaf.
Well, this is Broadway, don't forget. So coffee and cigarettes is what these people run on because it's zero calories and helps with energy. So
I am obsessed with High Point Coffee. For anyone who follows Gay for Pay Productions, may remember in November, all of our promotional videos were pretty much based around Lauren Bacall's High Point Coffee.
Yes.
Or just Lauren Bacall in general.
Yep. This is why I thought of you for this movie.
Yeah. We have a Q&A with Blake and Clay, with Jonathan and Daniel talking about what people are going to enjoy about the show. And, you know, I think they're going to enjoy the deep, rich flavor. is sort of just devolves into them directly quoting the commercials. But there was a lot of coffee and a lot of coffee talk, which was thrilling for me.
Yeah, I mean, those commercials are they hurt my heart just a little bit only because I know that Lauren Bacall struggled to get work from the 60s on, you know, until she had that resurgence after her Oscar nom.
Girl had to do what she had to do to, and she's gifted so many drag queens, so many sound bites.
Yep. She certainly has. Well, that voice, I mean.
Oh my God. I also, something that I was fixated on and continue to think about is the police officer that they send with her to sleep on the cot. When they send her home, the police officer sleeps on the cot. Mm-hmm. And I guess gets drugged by Lauren Bacall and knocks her out when she like escapes to her summer to her.
Is that what she did? To Anna Maria Horsford, you mean? The black woman.
Yes.
Yeah. Who was later on Amen. One of my favorite 80s actresses. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
She was lovely. And they go to the opening night, which I loved. Because she like really befriended the police officers.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of lovely. Huh. And she is walking her through her apartment. The door is open. He's trashed the place. She draws her gun. She walks into that apartment in heels.
She does?
I need to bring this to the attention of everyone.
That's amazing.
They walk in. The place has been turned over by the fan.
Yeah.
She pulls out her little stubby gun and she clip clops in her heels into the room. And when I tell you that she was so powerful in that moment.
Yeah.
But she spends the rest of her time in that apartment in heels. She wakes up from the cot, gets up. She slept in her heels.
Well, listen, it gives her stature. She needs to be impressive, intimidating.
But to say, I will defend you from this psycho killer fan.
Yeah.
And honey, I'm going to do it in my heels. I'm going to sleep in these power heels.
The only thing that matches that is Lauren Bacall smoking those long lady cigarettes in the hospital waiting room after.
In the hut. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And no one has a thing to say about it because it's 1981. And he's like, here, let me light you another cigarette. It's amazing.
I made a few notes on my phone. I gave up after a certain point because I was enthralled by the action. But the smoking in the hospital.
Yep.
It was right under mullets and big glasses. And oh my God, the fan, he not only has pictures of the object of his obsession, Lauren Bacall, mm-hmm. There's a Donna Summer poster right behind him.
Is there?
There is a Donna Summer poster right behind him. And so, we are to believe that he wants to fuck her.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, no, because again, it's his obsession with wanting to become her or for her to make him feel better about everything he hates about himself. That's usually why people become that level of obsessed with celebrities. So of course he doesn't want to have sex with her. Like, he doesn't want to make love to her.
No.
He wants to like meld with her is what he wants.
Yes, he wants to be her.
Yeah.
I also want to point out that this movie ran so Swim Fan could swim.
I still have never seen that film, if you can believe it.
Oh, it is such a, if you want a movie that was released in 2001, look no further. The lighting blew. Everything blew. The plot.
I
recall
that from the trailer, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I guess
Jesse that's guy, what's that guy's name?
I don't know. He's the guy who was in Bring It On.
Oh, that's right. He was. And he was in a he was in like an animal movie as well. He had a lot of work as a young man. And I always found him. At the time, I wasn't too old to decide whether or not I found he was attractive. And I found him to be really, really quite, again, a zero on the binary. Like, neither ugly nor attractive.
When I tell you that when my babysitter rented Bring It On one summer afternoon and my life changed, in so many, I was like, wow, they're talking so fast. That's interesting. And that, you know, formed my entire personality sensibility as a writer. But also when I tell you that I thought, you know, the Step Brothers seems really interesting and I just think we would get along really well. I don't know. Like, I think he seems really cool.
That's so cute.
Oh, so hot. Anyway, Swim Fan is the sort of this movie, but for teens.
Well, and speaking of visual elements as well. One thing I do love about this film is how good it looks. I think it looks so great. There are some moments of real visual splendor. Like, there's that overhead shot of him sitting in that mess of park benches.
Oh my God.
Which I don't even know what's going on there. Why are the park benches like that?
I don't know why the park benches were like that, but like, come on, Tarkovsky.
Yes, totally.
Come on, girl.
Totally. It's incredible. There's a lot of this movie is kind of like Eyes of Laura Mars in that way, except that movie is even more visually splendid. I mean, it's a real eye popper, and unfortunately, no pun intended. And unfortunately also not as good a thriller as it could be, but one whose aesthetic elements truly astound.
No, it had those that moment was so visually striking.
Yeah.
I was like,
and also her balcony, you know, when you see her, when he goes out on her balcony and she has like that beautiful New York summer night behind her.
Yes. Oh, her on the beach. Lovely. Her and her ex-husband on the beach. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah, it really did. And also, this is more of a general statement of that era, but I need to say two things, which is one, I loved that I could see everybody and what they were doing.
Yes.
I loved how well lit everybody was. Yeah. There was like a soft cream lighting over everything.
Yeah.
And when I tell you that I could hear the dialogue and what people were saying,
yeah.
Oh, what a treat.
Well, these are people who still got taught voice training at
Oh my God.
Bill. It's also not surprising that this is a director who spent most of his career in television, because that's sort of like, especially television of that era, is all medium close-ups and very clear dialogue and activity.
Yes. And that's why I was like, oh, I do feel like this feels vaguely SVU-ish. Like, it has a television energy to it.
I appreciate the respect that the movie has for Belle Goldman's character, in the fact that being an assistant to a famous person is a real slog of a job to get through. It's like being a seeing eye dog. You have to retire them after a few years because they kind of go insane from the pressure.
Is that a thing with service dogs?
Yeah, because they're trained to basically understand that someone's life is in their hands, and they can only handle the pressure of that for so long.
I can barely handle like a walk in the park, so God bless them.
I would imagine, like, the fact that Belle is so stressed out by the time they have that big fight. On the other hand, I'm like, but Lauren Bacall is right. Like, you shouldn't be writing people calling them disgusting or anything like that. Like, if he's writing rude things, just either don't respond or figure something else, or also pretend you're Sally Ross and just say, thanks for writing and I appreciate my fans and here's an autographed photo. Like, it's so funny to me that, and I know that it's because we need to get the plot underway and for things to escalate, but it's just so funny to me that she engages with him and responds like on a point by point basis. Like, this is what's wrong with what you're saying to us.
But I wonder if the cultural difference is, like, at the time, maybe a letter in the post was still a letter in the post, whereas now the concept of, like, over inundation with information,
right, and comments on posts.
Yeah, and
I could see that
is like a very basic thing.
Yeah,
I was not yet a twinkle in my father's eyes yet, so I don't know.
I think there's always been a sense of the way in which famous people handle the public, and then technology and societal change affects the details. But I think there's always been a way to handle the public because of the fact that you do need to keep their attention while keeping yourself safe and private away from them.
And I always say, look to Chet Hanks. What is Chet doing? What would Chet do?
I also love after Belle gets attacked and Lauren comes into the hospital. She's like, you look so much better today. And she's got like full like diapers pulled over her head. I mean, the bandages crisscrossing her face. And she's like, you look better today. I'm like, how does she look better today?
I don't know if it was the costumer or what, but the whatever medical professional dressed that face was holding a cigarette in the other hand.
That's right. It's so true. It's so true. And then at the end of the movie, when she comes back to work, she's got like a tiny line on the side of her face. I'm like, there's no way that a razor leaves that small. Like, there's just no way.
Carved into her like a jack-o'-lantern.
But it's a razor. Like, a razor would leave like a zipper scar. Yeah. It wouldn't leave just like a tiny faint mark. And then, you know, if her boss was worth her salt, she would pay for her to get good plastic surgery to minimize it as much as possible. But I don't think you could ever make it fully go away. At least not with the surgery technology of the time.
A little bit of concealer goes a long way, honey.
It's very true.
You slap some concealer on there, you powder it down, off you go. Stomping the runway.
But again, Lauren Bacall gives one hell of a performance in this movie. And again, it's a shame that the movie's not better. When he calls her and she speaks to him on the phone for the first time, that look on her face when she answers the phone and realizes it's him is incredible.
She's not phoning this movie in.
Not even for a second. Also because I think it's her first lead role in a movie, especially in a studio movie in a long time. And so she's she was probably doing jazzercise and swimming every day for 3 months before she started.
Oh my God, of course. Yeah. And I wondered that watching it, I was like, well, she's just, am I a gay man? And so am I predisposed to just like gag for you?
Yes.
Is she doing her version of phoning it in, which is still infinitely watchable? Because she is just watchable.
I've never seen
her
in anything where I thought she was phoning it in. I've seen Lauren Bacall's movies from every era of her career, and I don't know that there was ever a period where she.
But that's my question. Yeah. Is I'm like, do you have a version of phoning it in, and we would just never notice because you are so charming and captivating, like you are. Infinitely.
I know
watchable.
What you mean. I don't think so, though. This is a woman who, don't forget, as a teenager, stood outside of the restaurant where all the producers, she knew the movie people, hung out. Or was it in New York? So was it on Broadway? But anyway, she would hang out. She was like a leaflet girl, and she would just make sure to meet the right people. And she just kept at that for months until.
Good for her.
She like this, and I think that energy never left her. I think she was always that girl.
Yeah, right. And do you get like a, like in the sense that she was sort of always working, always like, you know, to use the modern parlance, always on the grind?
Always on the grind. After her ingenue years in the late 40s, and she's married to Bogey until about 1957, which is when he died, because he was, of course, like twice her age, right? And he also died very young. I think he was only in his late 50s when he died. And from then on, and this is not an era where being a celebrity meant being super rich. This is not $20 million dollars a movie. This is people who were basically upper middle class. Which is a good thing to be, but not necessarily dying with money problems taken care of for life. And so she had to work to keep the lifestyle to which she had become accustomed, but she had to work. And she's middle-aged by that point for the movie business, especially, again, because she never looked young. So Lauren Bacall in her 30s is not an ingenue. And pretty much everything you see her in from the late 50s until Mirror Has Two Faces is something she's doing because it's not that she needs the money. She just has her eye on keeping things going, keeping the lights on, keeping things.
Right.
Yeah. Including her biography, her autobiographies. She wrote those because they offered her a good deal. You know, it wasn't something that she came up with on her own. and Broadway came along and she took that. So I don't think she was ever miserable. I don't think she was slumming it, but I would not be surprised if there was a year she wanted to take off and she didn't think she could.
Right.
Yeah.
She, did you ever see, I think it's her on Carson talking about filming The African Queen. It's her reminiscing.
I think so.
Oh God. Just talking about Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
Just being drunk every day.
Yeah. I mean, they're a fascinating, I mean, those two were just like inseparable from when they first met. And you know, had he not died so young, probably would have stayed together a lot longer. It was probably right. A volatile relationship, but given that she was so much younger than him, you don't get the impression that there was an inequality of personalities there. Like, they seem to meet on the right level.
Right. I think that metatextual level really shines through in the movie.
Yeah.
In a way that I think were it made now would have, like, such a to-do would have been made about it. In the, you know, the buzzfeedery of it would certainly have been a thing.
Right.
But I really do think that it was present without really being milked.
Her having been married to a famous movie star, you mean?
No, just her being an actor of a certain age.
Yeah.
Her
having, I mean, she's playing a version of herself for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And it worked. It didn't crowd the movie.
Yeah, for sure. She's kind of playing what we assumed Lauren Bacall was really like anyway, even though she probably wasn't, but that's sort of how we assume. So we should definitely wrap things up, which means it's time to talk about the great Broadway musical, Never Say Never.
Never Say Never.
Which I wish this movie... What is that musical about? What is it about? She's wearing a sparkly pimp outfit at the beginning.
Yes.
There's a lot of scaffolding on stage. It's very early 80s Broadway. It's also like, that's a legit theater that they're performing in, but it's not like a huge theater. This is before sort of the Andrew Lloyd Webberization of Broadway. So you could go see a musical that wasn't necessarily being performed in a huge, like.
I loved that.
Yeah. I actually love that theater. I love the image at the end of her walking away and you get like the low ceiling over the seats. Like, I thought that was, again, a beautiful visual moment.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what is this show? That's the size theater that I'll see a play in now in New York. It's rare that you'll see a musical in a theater that size.
That's why I was like, I want this to be a thing again. I want a, you know, mid-tier musical.
Yeah. Which is what The Fringe gives you. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Not just scaffolding, but those dance twinks were climbing over in their glittery costumes, reaching, arching, just always just straining on the scaffolding.
And we get no sense of anything to do with the plot. This musical is more confusing than Hell's Kitchen or whatever it's called from Staying Alive. Because then there's an in Paris number with hookers.
There's hookers.
And then she's singing Hot Love Baby Tonight with shirtless men clambering all over her bed.
Yeah, a song not originated by this musical.
Okay. And then she sings Hearts and Diamonds. I mean, what a song. And the thing is, I love Lauren Bacall. I would pay top dollar to watch Lauren Bacall live doing anything. But she's not a singer. Lauren Bacall is an actor who can sing. Yeah. But you need to watch her. Like, she did the musical version of All About Eve. It makes sense. She would be perfect as Margot. And it would make sense that she brings her character-y voice to that musical.
I didn't know there was a musical version of that.
It's called Applause. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's not. Okay.
Yeah.
I watched the All About Eve... the National Theater did.
Oh.
On
like a dramatization of it?
No, they did it. Well, yeah, they did. They did a full play. They did a broadcast of it. And it is with Gillian Anderson.
Oh, okay.
And phenomenal. Absolutely fantastic.
It's a magnificent. I've never seen the musical. I don't know how it rates compared, but it was a big success for her. It definitely helped improve her Q rating in the 70s, late 70s.
Remind me what this opening number is. It's like, she's a spectacular woman. She's a particular woman.
She's a sensation. Yeah.
I want this musical. It kind of reminded me of the musical at the opening of Death Becomes Her.
I see me. You mean me. Da, 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 yes. da, which was a musical version of Sweet Bird of Youth.
Oh,
yeah. But in this one, I don't know what, like, it doesn't come across as a musical. It comes across as a cabaret is what
yes.
it, this not cabaret, but like a cabaret of just scenes and songs and whatever. It doesn't seem yeah. like it's about anything.
But Never Say Never sounds, the title evoke, yeah. like it feels like an early Weber. It feels
like it's Andy just Weber. Weird that they don't, in these all these rehearsal scenes, they just don't have one quick clip of her sipping a drink and saying, I don't understand why you never stick around. Like just one quick scene to just yeah. give us this, oh, it's a movie, it's a musical about a woman in love or something.
And I love that. I honestly loved that they left. Like it was so camp.
I just wanted to know. I needed more information because also, again, to go back to talking about integrating themes, it would also be interesting if the plot of this musical had something to do with the things that are going on in her life, like if it was about an aging actress or about an aging
yes,
woman.
Yes, again, if there was like another layer of metatextuality maybe going on.
And then on top of that, she needs this play to save her career. And on top of that, she's struggling to survive this mad killer. Like it's just interesting to me that the elements are all there and they don't quite come together, and it ends up basically being a straight thriller instead of being
yes
like a fascinating complex, you know, psychological drama of some kind,
which as faggots we demand.
Of course we demand it.
Of course,
which would have still been possible in the early 80s despite the fact that it's not the most revered time for Hollywood film.
But I also think that that's what's kind of frustrating is like that movie is not terribly far off from like
yeah
the base layers of that are all there, the basic architecture is all there.
Well, especially because one thing this movie does exceptionally well is that I love the ending. I love that it does not boil down to just a woman in peril.
Yeah.
There's that great sequence of him killing everybody and then she's stuck alone with him in the theater and then she snaps and she's like, I am done being scared. And then she plays her like reverse psychology on him. And it's fantastic.
It's also not overdrawn.
Absolutely. Also, how many men in this world were about to kiss Lauren Bacall and then she said, you're pathetic. Like, I wonder how many times that actually happened in real life.
That turn was lovely. I mean, turn, you obviously know that's what she's doing. But that entire sequence wasn't overdone. I kept waiting for the moment where she would be like dangling from the catwalk.
Yeah.
You know, like
for sure. And then a male cop comes in and shoots him just in time or something.
Yeah. But no, she does exactly what I was hoping she would do,
yes.
which in this instance was really satisfying. She uses everything she knows about him so far. And she uses the dynamic between them, which is.
Yeah.
Clearly you want to be me, clearly like you want me all for yourself, so we're gonna use that until I can gain the upper hand and just fully kill you.
And it has the audacity to belittle him, you know, when he says something she goes, what, speak up. And
I know,
she's not just mommy, she's mean mommy.
She's mean mommy in that moment. And it doesn't do the thing that, like, it doesn't pull the prestige TV move of like, he's sad,
right?
And isn't that sad? Like, don't you kind of feel for him right now? Which like has its own place and whatever. But like at the end of it, he is pathetic. He's disgusting. Everything he's done has been gross. Like, yes, you can empathize with him to a certain degree, but mommy still has to kill you now.
Yeah, and I love that mommy's making lists of good gays and bad gays, and you're on the wrong list.
You're on the wrong list, and you know what? She should make that list.
I find it hard to believe that Lauren Bacall could push a razor into a man's neck that easily.
I do not. Yeah. Oh, that easily? Sure. Yeah. That Lauren Bacall had it within her to just.
I think she was seconds away from doing it to people all the time.
And that's what gave her such power, and that's why we love mommy.
Yeah. And also that she wears that gorgeous gold sparkly dress while doing it.
Yeah. But you love mommy because you know that you also sort of have to fear mommy because she might kill you.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's, you know, that's the gay experience. I genuinely enjoyed this film.
Yeah.
I had a good time. I was surprised by the 33% that it got in Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
I will also say, next time anyone runs into Ryan G. Hines, Chronically Delightful, ask Ryan about the time he met Lauren Bacall. It's a great story.
I can't wait. I'm surprised that it gets such a low rating too, in that there is a difference for me of movies that don't quite make the mark but are still really enjoyable versus ones that are impossible to sit through. And also there are, it borders on that kind of you need to see it to believe it kind of movie.
Yeah.
Curtis, having you on again was an incredible pleasure. I'm so glad that we were able to do this. I have been so happy witnessing all the success of the show over the last year. It's been tons of fun for me as an audience member. I've seen it twice, and I can't wait to see it again. Thank you very, very much for joining me today. Please tell our listeners where they can find you.
Oh my God. Well, thank you, Bill. That's really lovely. I think if you liked the first one, you're going to love the second one because, as I keep saying, the first time we came for the straights, and this time we're coming for the gays. You can find me on, I think you can find me on Instagram at Curtis Campbell. I don't really think I'm on much else. Oh, you can find me on several platforms as Alanis Percocet, Toronto's Jagged Little Thrill, Alanis Percocet.
And they can find info about the show on Instagram as well, right?
They can find the information on Instagram. We are on Twitter as well. Check me out on those things. And I have a podcast, Lola and Lonnie. Yeah, I've been told it's funny. I think it's funny.
It's okay. No, I'm just kidding.
It's okay.
It's okay.
And I have a book coming out in the fall. It'll be probably on my Instagram or website. If you like me in general, you might like my book. Check it out.
Ugh, aggressive self-promotion. You can't get them to shut up about themselves, these millennials.
I just have so many things.
All right. Thank you so much, Curtis.
Thank you, darling. We'll be right back.